This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Therapy is an incredible tool for facing your fears and finding ways to overcome them. For me, I'm always nervous about the unknown. But sometimes the scariest thing is not facing our fears in the first place and holding ourselves back. For me, therapy has been an incredible motivating part of my life. It has helped me personally, professionally, with the podcast, learning more about myself, how to improve setting boundaries, working through problems, big and small. It has been the single best tool in my life to better my life. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Overcome your fears with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/andyscrolls today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/andyscrolls. Okay, you guys, it's Andy Scrolls. As promised, I felt the need, the urgent need to continue a little bit more of the Orange County season 15 conversation because there were some big, big moments and reveals that I left out. We have to talk about Elizabeth. Now, I watched Elizabeth's initial journey on the show, and I just kind of thought, like, she's different. Does she make sense? Is this someone who should be on reality TV? And then I just kind of felt like there was something about her energy that I thought was sweet and innocent, and that she was not of this world, the world of housewives and the world of reality TV filming housewives. But there was something about her where I was like, just like a bright shooting star, you know, this is only going to last but a moment. There is some stuff here to unpack. And the way that she was talking about her heartbreak, about her divorce, was interesting to me because I felt an intrinsic connection between Elizabeth and Sonia in that way, where Elizabeth is talking about how she was married to a billionaire, which I Googled this man's net worth. I think it was like 200 mil. So, I mean, not shekels, but I don't know. Maybe his company is worth a billion. Couldn't tell you. So it's this multi-bajillionaire, essentially. And she's talking about the loss she felt and feels navigating a pretty contentious divorce. And it feels like so much of her focus on the marriage was her focus on the lifestyle. And I mean, there was even a moment where she started to get a little, she started to spiral a little bit when she realized that Bronwyn's vow renewal wedding location was near her former house, which was giving me a little Morgan Letters energy of like, here is this moment where you're connecting with your past in such a way that you do genuinely spiral. I just felt like there was something between them. And also, Sonia can experience an alternate reality that's not necessarily built in truth. And obviously, throughout the season, there were a lot of questions about what appeared to be compulsive lying on Elizabeth's part. The most surprising for me was actually not that she may or may not have fucked her boyfriend before or after getting divorced, because I'm actually very confused about her saying that they are now, or at that point, were sleeping together, because I just, something about that, I was like, I don't know that I believe it. But I was actually less surprised about the revelation that she and Jimmy are in this like really complicated dynamic, and we don't really know if they've slept together or when that was. Versus the fact that she may not have the wealth that she said she did. And I don't know why that was so surprising to me. The first kind of warning sign should have been the fact that it was noun, verb, and I have millions. I mean, she kept expressing that. There was that weird charitable endeavor of her buying a Ferrari because she was going to donate it to charity a year later, which Andy questioned her about at the reunion. She said, you know, I haven't done it yet. I mean, I guess that's going by her timeline because she did say during the season that she was going to ride it for a year. But I didn't know exactly what that meant for Elizabeth, charity and access to financial resources. And I didn't look up all the loans that she and maybe took out. But when that became a part of the season plot, I was like, oh shit. So she's both out of this relationship, out of the lifestyle, and has been telling us over and over and over and over again that, like, at least she has all of this money coming out of it. And maybe that money wasn't real. Like, her ex definitely has a lot of real money, but I don't know exactly what she was left with. I definitely think it includes the beach house, which was worth several million dollars, but it does not appear necessarily that she has like a huge nest egg, even though the title cards at the end of this season wanted us to believe that she is now the richest or one of the richest women in Newport Beach. I don't know how much of that is really true. And I think the lying was obviously something that she was fighting against, including getting into tussles with Bronwyn about, you know, being called a liar or being called a liar, frankly, by other members of the cast. And then we find out, because she has a full-on panic attack and anxiety attack during this otherwise sort of mess of a cast trip to Lake Arrowhead, that she had experienced a lot of trauma when she was younger. Something that she certainly talked around through the season, through the episodes leading up to the season, but not in the way that she, from what she said as she broke down in Lake Arrowhead, that she had actually been forced to be a member of a religious cult in, oh God, I'm going to screw it up. I'm so sorry. I think Missouri. And it was a religious cult that her grandmother had founded. Her father was a preacher working at. She was threatened with death if she ever wrote down or told anyone what happened. And at a certain point, her mom was able to rescue herself and her brother by getting like an 18-wheeler or something and getting them out of the cult, which her mom had apparently tried to do prior and was essentially caught and brought back. They were finally able to escape. And then she was cut off from the members of her family still participating in said cult. And then they went to, I forget if it was, I think it was Washington maybe, with her mom and brother, because she had a family member there and they essentially had to start over. And part of that starting over was living in such a period of, in such a state of poverty that it wasn't just about identifying herself as this like woman of wealth, relating to just wanting to feel like connected to the other women in the cast. There was also a sense of wanting to escape her experiences as a child and really remake herself as someone who felt not just accepted, but important. And she also said, I think so much of the focus in the cult was on money. So it's interesting that she has focused so much on money, albeit in a very, very different way as an adult. And that also she had experienced sexual abuse while she was a child in this cult. They again threatened her with death if she told anyone. Her brother was beaten to the point where he thought he was going to die. Her brother, in a scene with her, you know, after the Lake Arrowhead trip, when she says, I told the cast about what we went through, says that their aunt died in front of them because no one in the cult was allowed to seek medical attention, including going to the hospital. Her aunt had an allergic reaction. And then the members of the cult, her grandmother, whomever, said, you know, the Lord will save her life. And when her aunt died in front of them, they said she was not pure enough to live. I mean, to experience that, the level of trauma that Elizabeth has gone through is something that I think most of us, find ourselves just shaken to hear. So to understand the self-protective kind of defensiveness and denial that she has wrapped around herself and around herself and around herself through the years, and also the lying of it, because she was told to lie. Lying was normalized and centralized for her when she was trapped in this extraordinarily abusive, violent environment for years and years. The way that lying would become not only just normalized, but a form of like trying to protect herself as she became an adult, protect herself, maybe her safety and feeling like she was safe in environments and not wanting people to know about what she experienced as a kid. I mean, it was really, really tough, obviously, to hear her talk about, but I'm glad that she was finally discussing it. And she had a therapy moment on camera toward the tail end of the season. It might have been at the finale. And I don't know, there was just something about the therapist that she was talking with where I was like, oh, this feels like a real person. It's not a celebrity doctor. It's not one of those things where I feel like this is just being done on camera. I don't know how long she continued the therapy, after the season wrapped. I hope she did. It felt like that person was really seeing her and supporting her in a way that I think is incredibly important for Elizabeth. And also the relationship with her then boyfriend was so confusing. And it also felt like it was in its own suspended reality of like trying to make this thing make sense. And obviously Elizabeth had a lot of, what was his name? I've already forgotten his name. I think it was Jimmy. Elizabeth had obviously expressed a lot of appreciation that he was there when nobody else was, when she was left by everyone, that the group of friends she thought she had around her were really just there because of the money that could provide for them these like incredible, crazy, 10-star vacations or presents or whatever else. When that went away, when she filed for divorce, so too did her circle of friends. And she found this person and they connected. And while the circumstances around their like expressions of sexual connection continue to be confusing, she attributed that to him being an introvert and also not wanting to discuss this stuff, that he came from a really conservative family and not wanting to discuss it on camera and feeling a level of embarrassment and upset when episodes aired because, Elizabeth said his mom watched and he was significantly younger than Elizabeth was. So I'm sure there's that dynamic too. And also feeling embarrassed that like your parent who's conservative and traditional is like hearing this conversation and the punchline and jokes are around her child's sex life with his girlfriend, and that's being recorded, and thousands of people have, or at least hundreds, I mean, it's season 15, have thoughts and feels about this. I'm sure that is a really, really tough dynamic to work out and work through. But also, she was not right for the show. I mean, I had an appreciation for her that I didn't anticipate, and obviously a lot of empathy for what she went through. But there were points where she was like crying during the reunion where I might have misheard this. And then they sort of asked her to explain it a little bit, but in a way that didn't necessarily go in the direction of what she initially intended, where she seemed upset that the storyline about her child aired on reality TV. And then the conversation shifted to like, what you experienced having had to go through that was obviously incredibly traumatizing and difficult. And also the opportunity of sharing what you went through with other people as a way to normalize talking about being a survivor and a survivor of sexual abuse, a survivor of physical abuse, survivor of being in a religious cult, that there was obviously a way that the show was trying to discuss her sharing her story, which began with her having a panic attack on camera because she, I'm sure, was having a physical response to like letting this stuff out that she was so, so, so afraid to put out there and bring into the light. I'm sure that she absolutely has an appreciation for the help it might have provided to others, but I do also think she genuinely was upset that it aired at all, that she felt like it shouldn't have been a part of the season. And that is something that the show obviously did not want to go anywhere near, but but at least that was my interpretation of some of her upset during the reunion itself. I don't know how other people felt. If you, in fact, watched season 15 and or watched the reunion, it felt like some of that initial frustration she was letting out was like, this shouldn't have been a part of the show. And then that conversation shifted a little bit, but I was still thinking about what she had said. I mean, there was a lot there to unpack. I do want to go back a little bit because there was a lot of like little moments spread throughout throughout episode 6 to really 14 from the classic part of the season through the reunion episodes 15 and 16 that I do want to get to. I thought it was interesting that Emily, I think this is when episodes picked up in episode 6 when I started to, get through the rest of the season after previously unpacking 1 through 5, that Emily was talking about the way that Matt seemed to use guilt to get Gina to do what he wanted, which is something that Gina herself addressed as the season went on. I thought it was really important that there was someone there who was an outsider to their marriage who was seeing very clearly what Gina later did, maybe things that she was struggling with saying out loud, which was just the level of control and authority he had, not just over their relationship and him being the sole breadwinner and him seemingly being the one who was having, you know, the majority of the power in their household, but also the way that he was using that guilt and power and control, including after they separated and got divorced, especially when it came to the question of accountability around the domestic violence, that he was still kind of relying on some of those impulses. And Gina really worked through the rest of the season to have put herself in a position where she said, that's not enough. And the way that you are treating me, the way that you are treating my trauma and trying to negate it because of a legal strategy or maybe just a refusal to admit a very, very, very serious wrong was unacceptable to her. And she would not allow him to take away from the trauma and reality of what she went through. As AGs know, I am spiritually mid-20s plus. And like many people, the conversation about saving and investing can feel really complicated. And for me personally, often feels like it's out of reach. Like I'm joining a conversation in the middle of it. I'm not quite sure really how to start, which is why I am so thankful for Acorns. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. BCC, PK, and Dorit. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. That's perfect for me and my life. I want to make positive change, but so often it's hard to figure out where to begin. Acorns does that work. I always felt like in order to start investing, I needed to have one big lump sum, but Acorns takes away that kind of stress. It's small, important changes that you can make in your life for your future. Head to acorns.com/andyscrolls or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/andyscrolls. Much like Jennifer Aiden on her last appearance on Watch What Happens Live, and I do mean last, when it comes to summer, I need to keep hydrated, and that's why I love Fiji water. Jen's thirst might not ever be quenched, but with Fiji water, mine always is. Fiji water is Earth's finest water. Unlike the other two top premium bottled water brands, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring. Fiji water has more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands, giving it its signature soft, smooth taste. And that's why Fiji Water is the number one premium imported bottled water brand in the U.S. And P.S., Fiji Water has a perfectly balanced 7.7 pH. Get stocked up on Fiji Water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick up some today. Alexis Bellino, imagine how much better her season could have gone if she had just simply quenched that thirst. And my recommendation? It's not just water, it's Fiji Water. I started taking Hormone Harmony because for me, that time of the month feels like it became the entire month, dealing with cravings, bloating, not feeling like myself. Well, now it's easier to manage PMS and menopause with Hormone Harmony. My number one, supporting hormonal balance and regulation. Hormone Harmony also helps relieve symptoms of menopause, improve sleep quality, relieves hot flashes and mood swings. Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. It is zero sugar and is gluten-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, and third-party tested. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over in their reviews, and there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ANDYSCROLLS at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ANDYSCROLLS for 15% off today. So I did do a little Google because I was like, what the fuck ended up happening? I couldn't remember. I thought I remembered that she had read a victim statement, but I did not remember the details. So I did do a little bit of a Google. So in 2021, nearly 2 years after the incident occurred, Matt Kirschenheiter pled guilty to one felony count of domestic battery with corporal injury of a spouse and guilty to one felony count of false imprisonment by menace, violence, fraud, or deceit. And this was an article on Heavy that unpacked Gina at the hearing, and it said Gina Kirschenheiter chose to read her victim impact statement at the hearing. It's hard, she told the judge, while already sobbing, as was originally reported by Us Weekly. I thought I was going to die. I still get chills thinking about how I begged you to stop. Think about the kids. And you, oh God, this is going to make me cry. And you responded by saying, your mom is going to die tonight. It echoes in my brain and it sinks deep in my heart. That night, it literally felt like I was, oh God, I'm going to cry. Okay. Let me just take a little sodium break. That night, it literally felt like I was in a house with a stranger whom I'd never met before. Your eyes were completely black and you were not Matt. It was so hard for me to believe that it was even you, but it was. It's taken me a lot of time, self-care, and therapy to work through what happened that night, but I have managed to forgive you for most of it. I accept that I will always have this painful memory from that night. I've come to terms with that. And then an OC judge later sentenced Matt to 180 days in county jail. He has to serve his time unless he wears a bracelet monitor, completes a 52-week batterer's program, and 3 years of formal probation, which I believe is what he ended up doing. And then his attorney said, Mr. Kirschenheiter is accepting responsibility for his actions and apologizes to Gina and his family. He is ready to move forward in his life and understands that accepting responsibility is a key step. Matt is a great father and looks forward to raising his children with Gina in a positive and loving environment. He has learned from this experience and taken proactive steps to ensure that this type of behavior will never repeat itself. Oh my God, some of that language is fascinating. There are really no words for the level of bravery that Gina took in sharing that statement and really refusing to bow to what was enormous pressure, surely, that Matt was utilizing. And for Gina to just stand in that courtroom and say, this is what happened to me. It was real. And this is how I was hurt is incredibly important. And I'm sure incredibly integral to her just continued healing, genuinely. So there was that. I did want to just share that little update, albeit an update from a couple years ago. And shifting gears a little bit to another co-parenting dynamic, Shannon talked during season 15 about David's refusal to co-parent. And that to me, I felt like was another example of someone refusing to cede control, where I felt like David, I'm sure there are many reasons for David's refusal to co-parent. He seems to be somebody who carries with him a lot of anger, a lot of anger, a lot of rage, a lot of dismissiveness, and I would think disrespect. And his refusal to co-parent makes me kind of think, like, is he refusing to do this because he doesn't want to see Shannon as an equal, where he felt he could flex a certain amount of authority and power and control because he was the one writing checks, he was the one paying the bills, he was the one in charge of their finances in that way, and that afforded him seemingly like the majority voice. And I just kind of wonder, since Shannon at this point was no longer his wife, what being an equal in his relationship to him and the fact that she didn't like owe him in the ways that he maybe felt that she did, how David, I would assume, would not want to participate in a dynamic where Shannon also has a voice, and a voice that he cannot immediately dismiss, that he might have to, God forbid, listen to her. Or maybe putting aside his anger because it would be about the kids, maybe that was like literal, obviously was too much for him. I don't know. It is wild. They have had some moments since. There was something at The Quiet Woman where like he had had a drink or two or something and was able to joke with her briefly, and they took a photo, which shocked the hell out of their kids when they sent them the pic to their daughters, or when Shannon sent the pic to their daughters, that they couldn't believe they were standing next to each other. That just makes me so sad, because there are dynamics where, you know, parents of divorced cannot communicate with each other. And it just, and there can be good reason for that potentially. But with this situation, it just makes me sad that he seemingly couldn't come to the table and just meet her and, you know, really focus on what the children's needs were. Because I don't know, it's also one of those things where if Shannon is in a committed relationship at this point with John Jansen, and he's like in a committed relationship and I think remarried at this point, the fact that they haven't met each other's partner, but their partners are spending so much time with their children, including minor children, is wild to me. It's just incredibly unfortunate. Because there's also a sharing of information that you would need to do. So continuing on, Kelly having this little moment of trying to stir up drama because she felt that Shannon was making something that seemed like a cheater brand of positive, what is it, positive beverage or positive water. Why on earth you would think that Kelly Dodd would be the spokesperson for a company with positive in the title? Is just like, she could be the spokesperson of, like, you know, fun water or activated water. No, that's more Lizzie Hubbard's route. Some other word, energetic water, just positive water does not, unless the campaign is like an LOL, like the marketing, it is a fascinating choice and business opportunity and partnership to have that, I guess, fell apart or separated at the peak of, you know, cancel Kelly in 2020-2021. So anyway, Kelly is stirring up drama because she feels that Shannon is coming for her business, or at least wants her business partners to feel that way. When Shannon repeatedly said, "I am not making a water. What I'm doing with Real for Real is making a lemon-focused tincture." The tincture is very different from water. And Kelly does this thing that she does often, which is to rile people up, get them upset, get them activated. I'm going to take back the word activated for this episode. Lindsay Hubbard, we're sharing custody of it. So Kelly does this thing where she just gets people upset, riles them up, and then says, "You know, why are you so mad? It's no big deal. You shouldn't be upset about this. This is nothing. You're doing too much," which is something that she does repeatedly. It's incredibly manipulative, but also, I guess, a character trait that's good for reality TV, because she's constantly in the mix. And I don't know how much of it she's really aware that she's doing. It doesn't make her behavior okay. But I sometimes wonder with Kelly, I'm like, do you know in this moment that you're misrepresenting, or also known as lying, misrepresenting what actually happened here? Like, are you aware that you were the person making this into a big deal? Like, do you understand that that was you who started this crazy, wild fucking ride? I don't know. I don't know that she is. She really might not. Does make it okay, but it just might be kind of one of those things. And also, so now they're, you know, the tincture thing happens at Bronwyn's vow renewal with Sean, and they have a drag queen be the person leading the ceremony, which they said was like, we're not really getting married again, but Bronwyn's coming out in a wedding dress. It felt like a marriage. And it, to me, I mean, you're making this big deal about having this person lead your ceremony. God bless. Great idea. Like, I assume that you have a relationship with them in some way. And one of their first lines in this room is, some of you, as a joke, some of you are a few cocktails in and the rest of you need to get caught up. Was, I couldn't believe it. I think I maybe awkwardly laughed at that moment because I'm like, did no one tell this person that Bronwyn is newly sober and, you know, having a lot of understandable nervousness about any kind of like public event that involves people drinking? And one of the first jokes they're saying in leading the vow renewal, like recommitment ceremony, is all y'all better, you know, drink up, like toot toot, let's turtle time. That to me was fascinating. Also, one of her older kids, Jacob, had decided to do a roast during the ceremony and was making fun of his mom's, I guess, obsession with money and whether or not his dad, whether or not Seanwyn would leave Bronwyn if he got famous and then run off with a 12-year-old American model. Let's not have kids roast in the future. It obviously landed with a thud. It was so strange. I really didn't know how to process it. It was just an odd moment at a really odd vow renewal, which was, there was not a lot of warmth there. It was just kind of strange. It was this by the book, we're doing this because I guess 10 years ago we said we would. We got married 20 years ago, 10-year anniversary, we did a vow renewal and then said, oh, we're going to do this every 10 years. I mean, listen, that's easier to do in terms of having to stand in front of everybody than what Seal did with Heidi Klum, which is where they did a vow renewal, I think every year until they split up. That's a lot of work. That is a lot of effort. Also, Jackie Christie, I don't know if she still does this on Basketball Wives, which I have not seen in several years. She also did a vow renewal every, or recommitment ceremony every year, which again, a lot of work, a lot of effort. It's just, do you need an anniversary party, but like with a ceremony every year that you stay together? I don't know. I couldn't tell you, but it was a little bit of a red alert when you looked at Bronwyn and Sean's behavior, because they just, there was not a lot there for them to hold on to. And obviously COVID did a huge fucking like double whammy on so many relationships. That's something that Shannon and John discussed as well. Like the fact that they were planning to live together pre-COVID and then COVID happens and you're sort of forced to be with each other 24/7. Also, it's not just that you're stuck with each other 24/7. You're stuck with each other 24/7 with a lack of information and a global pandemic. She has I think it's like permanent scarring on her lungs. So she was terrified. Also, she's not necessarily the greatest in an emergency. And she's dealing with that too, and trying to maintain some sense of control over the absolute uncontrollable while fearing that she's going to get this thing that may quite literally take her out. That is a lot of pressure to experience. Plus, you're dealing with living with your partner and their kids. They like combined families, which didn't go entirely well because at one point her twins snuck off to a party, which I think was and one of them tested positive after the fact, which I think led to, you know, the sort of COVID earthquake at Shannon's house. The other was John's son, Joe, said he wasn't going to go somewhere and did. The TLDR is the boundaries that they were trying to set with their teenagers were not entirely successful. And dealing with that stress was one thing, but it was another when Shannon essentially said to Joe, like, either you follow my rules or you gotta go. And so he said, bye-bye. And because Joe was leaving, John left. And then Shannon, I think it was in a confessional, said essentially, like, I felt like he was choosing his son instead of me. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, he's going to choose his son. Like, you felt like you were second best. Yeah, because he's choosing his son. It's not really, I don't know. I understand maybe a feeling of hurt, but I don't know how much surprise a person could really feel when a parent is saying, yeah, I have to leave. If my son is no longer going to live here, I'm going to go with him, which is really, really tough. I mean, that's a little tough to unpack.
Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build your own perfect clothes with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. I am so thankful to Armoire because I was in a genuine pickle last weekend. I was rushing to New Jersey, shout out NJ, the Garden State, not hunting for new housewives, but going to a friend's baby shower, and I had literally nothing to wear. So thank goodness for Armoire. I opened my bag from Armoire, grabbed this beautiful, bright lime green Sachin and Bobby midi dress, and it fit like a glove, and it saved me all of that extra stress. There are so many benefits to Armoire. You always have something new to wear without the hassle and closet clutter. It's sustainable. You no longer have to feel bad about only wearing an outfit once, and Armoire is women-founded and women-led. Right now, AGs can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/andyscrolls. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/andyscrolls to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
As AGs know, I am spiritually mid-20s plus. And you know who else is? My dear, close, personal best friend and also deity, Jennifer Lopez. J-Lo is actually the reason that Google launched Google Images, because of that infamous Versace dress. And she's still, 20 years later, more sought after than ever before. With skin like hers, it's not a surprise. Love don't cost a thing. But I don't want to continue to wait for tonight. Whoa. And thanks to JLo Beauty, we can glow right along with her. Get that JLo glow for yourself with JLo Beauty's Deluxe Kit, the one-and-done skincare solution clinically proven to tighten and lift for instant, long-lasting results. And much like my dear best friend, Jen, I absolutely agree. My personal favorite is JLo's Limitless Glow face mask. It is so soothing, easy to apply, cleansed my skin, had the mask on, and truly was having a spa night at home. So if you're tired of trying to crack your own skincare code, try JLo Beauty for 60 days. If you're not completely satisfied, just return the bottles, even if empty, and get your money back. Want that JLo glow? Head to jlobeauty.com/andyscrolls and get a special gift of 4 free masks for listeners of Andy Scrolls. Head to jlobeauty.com/andyscrolls for 4 free masks and free shipping today. That's jlobeauty.com/andyscrolls.
There are so many moments that make up a year. The big moments and milestones, birthdays, anniversaries, when Shan came to the clawfist. And then there are the small moments, the slow morning spent making a decadent breakfast, running to a grocery store to get 9 lemons to put in a bowl. All of these moments come together to create our year, and in the end, create our life. Artifact Uprising wants to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want to say, I love you with the perfect gift, display favorite memories in your home, or connect with loved ones throughout the year, BCC Shan, they have a product you can personalize. Artifact Uprising is a Colorado-based company that creates premium quality, customizable photo goods for your digital photos. I just ordered a few photo books with Artifact Uprising, a hardcover travel photo book in this gorge shade of Pacific blue, which is perfect for the credenza in my living room, devoted to my first ever trip to Paris, and a photo book in midnight blue, one for myself and for my family. Moments from my childhood, my parents spending time together, it is going to be the perfect gift for Tobes and Chard. This is something incredibly special.
that will keep us connected. Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, AGs can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you've purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use code AndySCrolls through December 31. And then we get into more of the COVID era, you know, that scene that I talked about, that moment that I talked about in the earlier episode of Bronwyn yelling at Sean and her daughter and essentially invalidating their feelings by saying that they competed with her own was a fucking shit show. Also, the style of filming, there were moments where I'm like, this is not as bad as I anticipated, but also this is twice as bad as I anticipated. Where the cast was trying to film with each other, but then we're being told that they're following their own kind of COVID law of like, oh, we're not sitting 6 feet away from each other, but you're both inside without masks on, and then you're sitting directly next to each other. So I think production was just trying to figure it out, and the cast was as well. And some of the cast just kind of like filming their own stuff. Maybe this again is more about Bronwyn than not, but it was tough to kind of watch, because then I'm just thinking like, okay, so somebody is filming this while you guys are fighting with each other. Who is the person with the camera and or phone? It's not someone in production. So is it Sherry? Is it one of your kids? Like, who is the person who has to take the footage of all of this? Because then it's almost like you're like kids putting on a show at home. Like, it just felt dramatic, but also just so fake at a certain point to just like film yourself. Does that make sense? Like, there's a certain level of credence of having like an actual crew with you and having production people there where you feel like you're a part of something, where maybe you're expressing anger or frustration, but it feels like it's more part of the whole. And then when that goes away, and P.S., I'm not like criticizing the fact that production wasn't there. Absolutely, they should not have been there. I'm just kind of remarking on just what that energy must have been like of like, okay, well, we're filming this thing and I guess you're just going to pick up your phone here and then I'm going to say some stuff and then we send the video to a producer, we like text it to her. I don't know how any of that worked. Did anyone ever write about that? Is there a deep dive? I understand why there wouldn't be, having watched all of season 15 at this point, a deep dive of how that worked from a production perspective. I would be super curious about an oral history of how all of this made sense, how we made decisions in real time, obviously constantly changing. There was one point where Kelly got a phone call from like the COVID, I think it was like a COVID nurse, probably working for production, at the very, very end of Lake Arrowhead, informing Kelly that she was near somebody who, she had been around someone who had since tested positive and needed to quarantine as a result. I mean, getting those calls, and then I'm thinking, okay, well, who's next to you? Who's like also hearing this news? Are they also quarantined? All of this, it's just a remembrance of how little we knew at that point, and just also how high stakes everything was, and understandably so. And then, of course, some moments I talked about prior, Bronwyn talking about being physically abusive toward Sean while in front of at least one of her kids was shocking to me. And also the fact that there was zero pushback when she's telling this story, like there's zero pushback from producer and sharing it in a confessional. There's not that they would introduce lower thirds or any information in the middle of an episode, but I don't even think there was one at the tail end of the episode. And production and the network are really not consistent with when they put, you know, if you were someone you know and the information, they're not great at doing that consistently. It's sort of unfortunate and a little cringe when you think about how they measure the need to do that. I don't remember that existing at the end of the episode where Bronwyn was talking about being physically abusive toward Sean, nor do I remember that happening at the end of the reunion episode in which that was discussed. But it was certainly distressing, obviously very, very upsetting to hear, and to have it just kind of be talked about in a way that to me really truly felt flippant, which I obviously had thoughts about, none of which were positive. Then we see that Bronwyn is going to protest, although we never got an understanding of why she had a professional photographer taking her photos. Like, her photos when she was posting, some of them on Instagram were stamped with the photographer's information, which is really not great. It does not, it doesn't mean that Bronwyn doesn't believe what she's feeling, but it does mean that often she finds a specific way of centering herself, which is unfortunate. You know, there's not really a lot to say about the level of cringe and uncomfortable that I felt in watching Kelly spout so much misinformation and ignorance and racist ideology during this season, just kind of shouting. She's someone who's very, very focused on saying cancel culture doesn't allow for another person's perspective, but then you see her using those tactics to get other people to shut the fuck up or to say that they're somehow wrong because they don't agree with her or genuinely feel that her thinking is dangerous. It's just, we can't go back there. We cannot go back to season 15 in that way. Like, it makes a person remember everything that Kelly was saying on social media, and to see her show such little understanding of how ignorant some of what she was saying was, but also doubling and tripling down and not being able to communicate anything effectively. So it was just these kind of like half sentence punches into the air. It was really, really tough to figure out and to understand. So we get toward the end of the season. You know, there are these moments where we're hearing about Elizabeth, we're hearing about what's going to happen with next steps with Matt and Gina. Obviously, Shannon wants her fairy tale moment to happen. And then we get into the two-part reunion itself. And the Shannon saying that John is a private person. She had to convince him to be on the show. How dare, you know, Bronwyn and Gina say these things. Shannon thinks that Gina is being holier than thou by essentially just sharing back information that Shannon doesn't have any memory of communicating because she was drinking at the moment in which she's like making these calls and venting. I wonder for Shannon, the private person description of John is something that she has often said. And it feels like she was saying that in a way to say that we should maybe be grateful that he's on the show or to be thankful that he's on the show. And I understand that in part, if this person is uncomfortable being on camera, that like, yes, this is a sacrifice they're making for your relationship and likely not something he was looking for. But also, judging by his behavior now in real time, his comfort sending out exclusive interviews and statements to people, everything going on with Alexis, which seemed like a public fuck you at the beginning. And then these two people fell in love with, I guess, the attention and also each other. One of those followed the other. Couldn't tell you which, except I absolutely could. It started with the attention. I just kind of wonder for Shannon if she's going to rethink the level of privacy that John seemed to prefer. And that might still be true. It might be like, yeah, he was a private person and then he changed. Or it might be that maybe I didn't know him very well. Maybe I believed him with some of these things and maybe that was undeserved. Or maybe he really genuinely was private and was, I don't know, financially generous. I don't even know what. And then things changed and then things shifted. I mean, we heard in later seasons that he liked the lifestyle. He liked having access to fame and celebrity and money. So I wonder how that is going to be discussed when Alexis is in the room. Like, obviously she feels that she is dating an entirely different person than Shannon did, but that doesn't necessarily change the cast members' opinions of John, who all watched really toxic behavior. There's a lot of stuff that we didn't see where there's like a little bit, I just keep saying where there's like a little bit over and over again, so I apologize, where it feels that there's a little bit of a whisper campaign of like, you know, he's kind of a piece of shit, but we can't really get into it. We can't really say it, but it's definitely true. It's definitely real. Then, of course, things are getting contentious between Shannon and Bronwyn, and Bronwyn and everybody else. And Shannon, you know, earlier on in the reunion is having a conversation with John on the phone while she's in one of the reunion like production trailers, and is saying, I'm going to bring up this stuff about Stella. Essentially, if she tests me, I think I'm going to have to bring it up. And then in front of the cast and Bronwyn, and this seemed to be news to her, Shannon tells the story that when Stella was at 14 and at some barbecue group event, Bronwyn went up to her and said, if you want the good stuff, come to me, which is shocking and disturbing. And when you think of what Bronwyn has been accused of and admitted to over the course of this season, it's just so much. It's just so dark. She reacts to it immediately, apologizes, breaks down, apologizes again later in the episode, but it just shows how entirely out of control she was, just entirely immeasurably out of control. And also that while it is great that she is sober, it is great that she is discovering her sexuality, it feels oftentimes like people come at the cost of Bronwyn better understanding herself. And that's unfortunate. And Gina, you know, during the reunion says Bronwyn's boundaries move where she wants them to move. Oh my God, what a reunion it was to experience. I don't know why I felt the need to unpack Orange County more. Maybe this was just my way of kind of putting this to bed. There were other things I didn't get to, obviously, more of the specifics around Kelly's 23andMe, her Drunk Wives Matter hat, which she said was made prior to the Black Lives Matter movement becoming well known, and it was just a play on words, so she didn't mean anything. So people are pulling out of their ass that she was directly mocking Black Lives Matter by wearing a hat that says Drunk Wives Matter. But obviously that was the point of it. The point is not when it was made. The point of it is, why are you wearing it now? Like, you can't argue with Kelly at a certain, it's a toxic cycle that I don't want to get anywhere near. And there were other things she said when she said that she thought Bronwyn was lying and saying that she was an alcoholic for a storyline. I don't see that. I really don't. I understand that people dislike Bronwyn. There's a lot of good reason to, frankly, but, I think Gina and Emily's reactions to that of like, no, you don't understand, in real time behind the scenes, some people did feel that way. And I said to them, no, this is entirely, entirely real. If Kelly won't believe Bronwyn, then believe your cast members who do not like Bronwyn, who believe Bronwyn. It's just these crossing of lines that was just so unfortunate and so inappropriate. But we got through it. We got through it. It was a tough, difficult journey, but it was one that I'm glad we're done with and I will hopefully never discuss again. So thanks for listening to this PS episode, which I really appreciate. And you can send me your thoughts and feels over Instagram at Dame Galley. Follow the AG Patreon, number one way to support the pod, at patreon.com/andysgirls. And thanks for following along. And I'm going to shift gears over to a surprise part deux of this deep dive, because I asked AGs on IG for questions about Orange County season 15 and season 18, everything from the past, present to the future of OC, just getting us ready for the premiere. Am I right? Let's squeeze that goddamn juice. So listen to that episode, available now.